Welcome back to Robbinsdale Revisited, the podcast where we read old newspaper clippings at the bottom of the drawers and dig through local archives to share the quirky, dramatic, and fascinating history of Minnesota's favorite first-ring suburb. I'm Crystal Boyd, and I might be the youngest member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Pete Ritchie. Even though I'm 20 years older than Crystal Boyd, I am the youngest ever president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Today, we're taking a deep dive into one of our area's most iconic natural landmarks, Twin Lake.
The tale of Twin Lake, it's going to be a wet one. We're talking about the founding visionary who built a Victorian mansion on the lake shores, the local pioneer family who practically ran the lake for six decades, and an uncharted island explorer. We'll also talk about giant monster fish and a historic 1950s civil rights battle that started right here on the sand.
Now, before we introduce our cast of characters, including the Trump family, we do have to clear up the obvious question. No, before anyone pulls over to Google it, there is no relation.
No relation whatsoever. The Trumps that we're talking about came up here from Iowa in 1890. They were local merchants and civic leaders, firefighters, and boat rental proprietors. They were a fixture of Robbinsdale for nearly 60 years.
And the Trump family, like the Robbins family, had five daughters. But they also had a son, Jack Trump, who was on the fire department for a number of years. Mother, Catherine Trump, and daughter, Ruth Trump, were shutterbugs. So one of the reasons we know so much about the Trump family, or at least can daydream so much about the Trump family, is we have all these beautiful photos. Catherine Trump took pictures that were a little more novel than what you see. They weren't stiff, formal pictures.
Wow. And we have a little piece of Trump family history right here at the museum.
Yeah, and this came in recently. So this great big wooden chest of tools arrives. And the story with it is when the Trump home was torn down and they built some apartment buildings, and it's just north of 42nd on West Broadway. The apartment building, I think, is called Twin Lake Apartments. In some ways, it's like a little Trump tower. There used to be a beautiful home there. It was kind of a Dutch colonial. It had kind of this strange pitched roof. And that was the Trump family home. When it was torn down in the 70s, there were some renters there. And so they were being evicted, and they were cleaning out the garage, and there was this great big chest of tools. And, well, it just went with them. And then it sat around in their basement for a number of years. And eventually, we were contacted, and they brought in this giant chest of old tools. There was one of the Robbinsdale nail guns was in it, a catalog was in it, and some of the tools are even etched with the Trump name. I'm guessing these guys owned a hardware store, so they probably used these tools to build their house. There was a catalog of tools, probably something they used to order at the hardware store, and it was just a heck of a find. It takes up a lot of room, but we're happy to have it. So before we jump into the stories, we should orient everyone with the geography of Twin Lake. So we got Lower Twin Lake, that's in Robbinsdale. And then you have Middle Twin Lake, and that's in Brooklyn Center and in Crystal. And then there's Upper Twin Lake, which is also in Crystal and Brooklyn Center. Between Lower Twin Lake and Middle Twin Lake, you've got Highway 100 roaring across the middle. And then between Upper Twin Lake and Middle Twin Lake, you've got the railroad tracks cutting through sort of a swampy area, but you can get to all three lakes or all three portions of the body of water in a canoe or a small boat.
Yeah, that's right. And over the years, civil engineering projects dramatically reshaped some of those shorelines. One of the most notable changes was in the 1960s when St. Cyr Bay was excavated. That was carved out on Lower Twin Lake to create new residential waterfront and expanded the lake footprint even further.
To really understand Twin Lake history, though, you have to start with the man who looked at that stretch of prairie and oak savanna and marshland in 1886 and saw a thriving town, Andrew B. Robbins.
Andrew Robbins was an inventor and an entrepreneur. He was also a Civil War veteran and state legislator. He bought 90 acres in what was then called the Village of Crystal and went to work. He didn't just plat streets. He built factories and established a streetcar line called the Northside Street Railway that eventually connected right into Minneapolis.
So we should mention Andrew B. Robbins purchased much of his land from the Shumways, and they still own the lower part of Lower Twin Lake. And right on the shores of Twin Lake, on 20 beautiful wooded acres, he built his own personal dream home, the Orchards, also known as Robbinsdale Park.
Work on the property began in 1888. They had 13 teams of horses and 25 men grading the hill and moving that dirt down to the lakeshore. The house itself was started in April 1890, and by November of that same year, Andrew and his wife Adelaide moved in.
It was a classic, massive Queen Anne-style mansion. 16 rooms, 5 fireplaces, stained glass, polished woodwork, and modern indoor plumbing. Each bedroom had a marble washstand and running water. It had a rounded tower with a conical roof and a 2-story arcaded porch.
And I love Adelaide Robbins. She was a serious horticulturalist. She turned the 8 acres of manicured lawn into a botanical masterpiece. Just think about the spring-fed ponds, fountains. She had walking paths and beautiful catalpa trees. There was even a conservatory attached to the dining room that was filled with delicate plants, and she would label each one of them with their proper Latin names.
They had Jersey cows, a stocked fish pond, apple orchards, and chicken coops. Get a load of this. By 1910, the house was valued at $13,500. The family piano carried a $1,000 insurance policy, and the chickens were insured for $1.50 per bird. While the orchards was eventually raised around 1942, Andrew B. Robbins' vision set the entire template for Robbinsdale and Twin Lake.
Right around the exact same time that Andrew Robbins was finishing his mansion in 1890, John Trump arrived from Iowa. He broke ground at 42nd and West Broadway, that's where the Wicked Wart is today, and John Trump built a general store, later expanding into hardware and adding a feed mill in 1896 that cost $850.
Yeah, and the Trumps lived right on West Broadway. Their longtime family home was actually behind the store, and then later they built a house at 4259 West Broadway. Under the old numbering, it was known as 4559 West Broadway. And they were living above their store, and then they moved just down the block to the other side of 42nd.
John Trump served as village treasurer for 15 years, and he was on the volunteer fire department. Archives even mention his loyal bulldog, who used to follow the firemen to every call, and the dog could actually climb ladders. John Trump's wife, Catherine, was a charter member of the Library Club, and she also served as first president of the Sacred Heart Rosary Society.
Trumps had to wait a while for a Catholic church. A lot of the pictures I've seen of them, they're sitting on the front porch of the Congregational Church, and since their house was really close to that, the Congregational Church appears in these pictures. It looks like they're standing in front of it. I didn't know they were Catholics. I also know that they're all buried down in South Minneapolis, right off of 46th and Chicago. There's a large Catholic cemetery. So for a long time, they didn't have any place to go to church in Robbinsdale. But eventually, Sacred Heart comes along in 1911 or so. So we have to talk about one of my favorite 1890s newspaper finds. It was a full-page ad in the Minneapolis Tribune from 1892. And it's sort of a snake oil salesman ad.
And the headline is, "Turned Johnny Trump from the Slough of Despondency to the High Road of Happiness."
Mrs. Catherine Trump gave a glowing testimonial for Doctors McCoy and Blair out of the West Hotel in Minneapolis. 13-year-old Johnny had been in a terrible way. He had a racking, dry cough, swollen eyelids, stopped-up nose, and a strange buzzing noise in his ears. Catherine was terrified. It was turning into consumption or tuberculosis.
She took him to Dr. Blair, and lo and behold, after treatment, her son's appetite came back. His eyes cleared up, and he gained 10 pounds. The newspaper declared him a changed boy.
It's an amazing snapshot of 19th century medical advertising, but young Johnny was definitely cured because 15 years later, he and his sister Ruth made statewide headlines for an entirely different reason. Picture this. November 1907, early morning around 8 a.m., a gang of cracksmen, or safecrackers, break into the rear of the Robbinsdale State Bank right across the street from the Trump store.
They set off a heavy charge of nitroglycerin against the vault door. The blast shakes the whole building, but the heavy door holds. So the robbers start prepping a second charge of nitro.
Living upstairs over their store on West Broadway, John Trump and his now grown Johnny hear the explosion. They don't hide. They grab their rifles, run to the window, and see the men at work inside the bank. The Trumps start firing shots right through the bank windows.
The robbers detonate the second charge and bolt out the door, with John and Johnny chasing them down the street, firing as they run.
Meanwhile, John's 16-year-old daughter, Ruth, decides she needs to wake up the whole town. She races down the street to the dark town hall, slips inside, grabs the heavy rope, and starts ringing the village fire bell for all she's worth.
So men jump out of bed, thinking there's a massive fire, only to find 16-year-old Ruth ringing the bell and directing them to the bank chase. The robbers escaped towards Camden Place, but because of the Trumps, they didn't get a single penny.
I'm thinking about some of the other things I've read about Ruth Trump. Not only was she a shutterbug who enjoyed taking pictures, she graduated from the University of Minnesota, and she went into the medical profession later. She had one of the first cars in Robbinsdale. I mean, the Trump family had the car, but all the pictures you see are Ruth driving it. And I know they took the car all the way to Winnipeg, and this was 1910. There just weren't that many cars on the roads. The roads were terrible, and it was a Rambler that they took up to Winnipeg and drove around town, and they were all very proud of the car. While the store and the bank defense were legendary, not quite as legendary as in Northfield, but maybe we should celebrate with Robbinsdale Days, Ruth saving the bank. What most locals remembered about the Trumps was Trump's landing on the west side of Twin Lake.
If you wanted to go fishing or row on the lake, you went to Trump's store on West Broadway, where you picked up your oars, bait, and tackle, and then headed down to their boathouse on Lower Twin Lake.
And Trump's Landing sits right about where the boat launch is today. They didn't own that piece of land, but they did build a little boathouse. I think they had an arrangement with the Robbins family, and we've got some pictures of the boathouse and the Trump girls standing out in front of it. And Twin Lake in those early decades was wild. In 1908, two local boys, Stanley McCurdy and Oscar Carlson, were crappie fishing when they hooked an 18-pound pickerel over 2 feet long. The Minneapolis Journal declared it was big enough to swallow a baby.
A pickerel ate my baby.
Very good.
Then in 1914, you have the unbelievable story of 26-year-old Frank B. Lees. Frank just happened to notice that an island he remembered in Twin Lake didn't show up on the official government survey maps from 1854. And his theory was that the original surveyors were paid $7 a mile, so they rushed the job and missed the island.
So Frank rowed out, built a 10-by-12 squatter's shack in the oak trees, and claimed the two-acre island by right of discovery. When shoreline owner Mrs. Kate Howe tried to have him ejected as a trespasser, Frank refused to move, waiting on federal papers from Washington. You have to love the audacity of discovering an island 7 miles from downtown Minneapolis.
And then we can't forget Theodore Wirth's grand vision in 1929. Mayor Harvey Morse brought the famed Minneapolis Park Superintendent out to Robbinsdale to inspect the lakes. Wirth was so inspired that he designed a $2 million master plan, including a continuous park boulevard around Crystal Lake and Twin Lake, complete with a dredged canal connecting the two.
I've always wondered about this big, beautiful house that sits at about 48th and Quail, on the west side of Middle Twin Lake. It looks like it belongs in South Minneapolis. It's all brick. It's got a red tile roof. It has some craftsman features to it. It's about 3 stories high. And there are lots of beautiful homes around Twin Lake, some built in the 40s. Most of them were built in the 50s and 60s. But this one was built in 1929. And I wonder if Theodore Wirth's vision had come to pass, if Twin Lake would have been surrounded by beautiful homes like that and maybe a parkway. It came to naught.
Oh, yeah, that's so hilarious.
By the 1940s and 50s, Twin Lake Beach had become the place in the summer for kids across North Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, and Crystal.
Emil and Ted Engberg ran the beach, and people really remember Emil. He was a former boxer, and he would stand at the entrance gate in his white outfit, super tanned, selling popsicles and 15-cent entry tickets. Pro wrestler Vern Gagne even gave swimming lessons there at the beach in 1945. The beach had a high dive, a steel pipe gymnastics bar out over the water, and lifeguards everywhere.
In the winter, the Engbergs built a warming house, cleared the ice, and lit up the lake. They played music so everyone could ice skate for free, but the beach was also the site of a major local drama. In June 1942, you had the Battle of Crystal Beach. A local resident named Arnold Samuelson led 75 people down to Fairview Avenue to pull up wooden guard posts that the village council had installed to block vehicle access.
Samuelson claimed the street and beach were dedicated public land. He unbolted a post, loaded it onto his car, challenged the constable to arrest him, and ended up going to trial in Robbinsdale City Hall.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are speaking to you from the corridor in the courthouse. In just a few moments, we'll enter the courtroom for today's case of Order in the Court.
Isn't it weird to think we had trials in Robbinsdale City Hall, and I've seen pictures of them. They put up benches, they put the judge at the front of the room, and they had all sorts of little trials there. It seems odd, and I think that went on until the 1950s and maybe even the 60s. While the Battle of Crystal Beach made local headlines, a more impactful legal precedent took place at Twin Lake Beach in August of 1950.
Jack Simus, a child care supervisor with the State Welfare Division, brought four young state wards from a group home in St. Paul out to Twin Lake Beach for a picnic and a swim. Three of the boys were white, and one was a 14-year-old black youth named Robert Baker.
When Robert approached the gate with a 15-cent admission fee, beach operator Emil Engberg refused to give him entry, stating no colored boys allowed. Robert selflessly told his friends, go ahead without him, but all three boys refused to enter without Robert.
Jack Simus confronted Engberg, warning him that he was violating Minnesota's anti-discrimination statutes. Engberg essentially dared him to report the issue. Simus packed the boys into the car, took them to a public beach in Minneapolis instead, and immediately filed formal complaints.
Engberg was arrested and bound over for trial. His defense lawyers argued that because private beaches weren't explicitly named in the state law, unlike saloons, hotels, or barbershops, he had the right to exclude anyone he chose.
Municipal Judge Leslie L. Anderson firmly rejected that defense, stating, "Times have changed. I'd rather take a fresh and open viewpoint."
The case went to a district court jury, which found Engberg guilty. It was a landmark ruling believed to be the first conviction in Minnesota history that applied the state's equal accommodations catch-all clause to private recreational facilities. It set a critical civil rights precedent right on the shores of Twin Lake.
Following that landmark court ruling, the beach continued to be a vibrant summer hub throughout the late 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, leaving a trove of nostalgic memories for generations of local kids.
Oh, absolutely. Thousands of people remember taking the bus down to Twin Lake or making the trek on foot from North Minneapolis and Crystal. But the biggest ritual of all was navigating the crossing at Highway 100.
Which sounds dangerous because before modern freeway pedestrian overpasses were built, kids would just trek down 42nd Avenue or across the railroad tracks, holding their beach towels and inner tubes, waiting for a break in the speeding Highway 100 traffic so they could sprint across four lanes of highway just to reach the sand.
It was terrifying. I remember doing it with my bike, and I can't believe we did that. Once you made it across safely, you were rewarded with the iconic Twin Lake summer atmosphere. You could smell the fresh popcorn from the concession stand before you even got off the pavement. Kids would spend all afternoon on the wooden raft in the deep end, competing in epic games of King of the Hill or trying to muster the courage to leap off the high dive.
And there were lots of local love stories. So many couples who met at the beach as teenagers in the 1960s ended up writing into the Historical Society decades later to share how a summer afternoon at Twin Lake Beach turned into a 50-year marriage. From Victorian mansions and 1890s Cure ads to bank-defending teens, rogue island settlers, civil rights breakthroughs, and sunny beach days, Twin Lakes history is deeply woven into the fabric of Robbinsdale's community.
The Trump family name was an institution for nearly 60 years, while their home and business buildings on West Broadway were eventually torn down in 1970 for apartments and the orchards are long gone, you can still feel that history whenever you take that big old highway across beautiful Twin Lake.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.
And here's a whiz-bang fairy tale from Captain Billy's whiz-bang, May 24th, 1924. She was a vision of delight, fragile as a Dresden doll, and with a figure of exquisite beauty, she sat on the hotel porch, dreaming of moonlit nights, gondolas, and sweet serenades. A tall, handsome man approached, stopped near her, leaned on the rail of the porch, and gazed across the moonlight waters. She looked into his eyes flirtatiously.
"Meet me at midnight," she breathed in his ear. "You are my mate. I love you. I'll leave my husband. We'll sell my jewels. They are worth a king's ransom, and we'll see the world together. But promise me that you'll meet me at midnight. Will you?"
The man looked at her but did not answer. He wore the patient, vacant look of the deaf, but he wasn't. He neither understood nor spoke English. Oh, geez. Oh, gosh. The poor Swede.
Oh, no.
Thank you. On several occasions during the last few days, the attention of the residents of the village has been attracted by some very strange atmospherical disturbances. During a dead calm, the wind, without any previous indications, would spring up with the force of a small cyclone. This phenomena greatly puzzled several, and considerable satisfaction is expressed that at last the puzzle is solved. It seems Deacon J.P. Shumway has invested in a brand new bicycle and is endeavoring to properly train the unknown critter to become modest and gentle, as it no doubt will in time, but at present it is very sulky and sometimes very rancantankerous. The deacon practices on his lawn, which has a decidedly western slope, and several times in the past the bike has started down that slope with a velocity that would make John Johnson blush. Everything goes along lovely, providing the machine doesn't shy to one side. But invariably, after a good shy, there is always a slight accident, and the boys are willing to help to find any missing parts, either of the machine or rider. Occasionally, a trip will be made without any accident, and it is these trips that starts the wind a-blowing. People who are posted on bicycle riding claim that Mr. Shumway will never become one of the most graceful riders, but the enthusiastic energy and stolid determination, assisted by a peculiar short jerky side wheel pedal motion and the odd manner in which he evenly divides his whiskers on either side to keep his balance and catch the wind, will eventually place the deacon in the front of fancy riders. Published in Thomas Gerling's picturesque Robbinsdale newspaper, Volume 3, Number 2, March 1894.